Hi, welcome back everyone. As usual, a few bits of information first. So, if you want to interact with us, you can do so by sending us questions, requests, or memes on Mastodon by using the hashtag #Shonks23. You can talk to us in the IRC chat on irc.hackint.org in the channel Shonks23. We've got a social viewing in the aquarium in Jitsi. The link can be found on our homepage, fireshonks.org. We have a YouTube and a Twitch channel, which we stream to, each at Fireshonks. Those two channels also have a live chat, which we will also monitor for questions. Our mainstream streaming channel is at streaming.media.ccc.de under the name Fireshonks with Relife. Today, I've got Amy Spark with me. They are a software development contractor, jack of many trades when it comes to desktop app. In a past life, they specialized in material appearance modeling, high-performance computing, and imaging. Today, they're talking to us about the unsung heroes of imaging. This talk will introduce Luma-Chroma color spaces, what they are, the reasons for existence, why they are useful, and real-world examples.
Hey all, good afternoon. My name is Amy Spark, and the title of this talk is The Unsung Heroes of Imaging. For a bit of background about myself, I work for the British company Centricular as an upstream and compiler breaker. We are fine purveyors of free and open source software consulting, and our primary responsibility is the maintainership of the GStreamer multimedia framework. Throughout the years, I specialize a lot in color spaces, sims, assembly language, build systems, in short, anything that can be cursed. And I have also contributed on occasion to a lot of projects, mostly related to color modeling, sims, and so on, all of them free and open source software. So, as a motivation for the reason for this talk, I bet that most of you have heard of terms like JPG picture, PNG. Some other folks may have also used the TIFF file format. If you have watched TV, you may have also heard about stuff like PAL, NTSC, CCAM, so on. So the question is, how do we store and broadcast color images? So for instance, why is a picture stored in the JPG file format so small compared to, say, the PNG equivalent, the TIFF equivalent, the RAW equivalent that we get as a RAW format from the cameras? Another question is, how can we watch those cat videos on phones and not get blown away by the bandwidth? Another further question is, how were we able to watch color TV before the advent of the PCs in our homes? The answer to all of these questions is that there is a Luma-Chroma color space involved to compress them. There is lots of background to cover, so I hope you are all ready. And for those that live on the crest of the wave, be sure that there is also HDR covered in this talk. This talk is divided roughly into four sections. In the first section, I will explain the very basics of color spaces. In the second section, I will explain a lot of about Luma-Chroma color spaces, what they are, and what they can be used for. In the third section, I will explain a lot of examples that are currently in use and some that were part of the ancient story of computer science. And in that section, I will summarize the things that we have seen and make some remarks about the stuff that can be covered in the future. So, without further ado, let us start with the introduction to the world of Luma-Chroma color spaces. How are colors specified? To process the light that we see around us into a color image that we can later store or transmit or whatever, we need to start thinking of colors as coordinates in a color space. To put it a bit more formally, a color space is an n-dimensional geometrical model, for instance, three-dimensional, that turns light stimuli, that is to say colors, into vector coordinates back and forth. For instance, if you have already taken a picture with your camera or phone, or if you have browsed the web, you have already run across color spaces. That is because the sRGB color space powers most of the consumer content nowadays. To put it in a more formal or mathematical footing, a color space is a coordinate system on which you define a subspace along with a mapping function from a supported color to a single point inside that subspace. And finally, the set of supported colors that you obtain is what we call the color space gamut or range. To give a formal or standardized definition of a color space, you need two sets of components. First, you need to specify the primaries, that is to say, three independent reference stimuli. And two, you need to specify the color of the light source that we call the white point or the luminant. These components are represented by what we call chromaticity coordinates, and plotting them into what we call chromaticity diagrams reveals the color space gamut. For instance, on the right, you have the chromaticity gamut of one of the color spaces that we will see later, called BT709 ICPCR. The vertices of the triangle are the three independent primaries. The little dot in the middle is the coordinates of the light source or the luminant, in this case, D65. And the whole area of the triangle represents the gamut that the ICPCR can cover. Now, there is a bit of a misnomer or some inconsistency between books as regards the storage and transmitter of color data. And to solve that, we need to go from the abstract to a more concrete definition. If we do so, we have color model types, then color models, then color spaces, we are here, and finally, the most concrete implementation, which is color encoding. I'm going to make a strong emphasis on the first item, color model types, and the rest will arise easily through some examples that I will show in the next few slides. The type of a color model tells the practitioner how the primaries represent colors. We have additive color models that work by mixing light stimuli to form colors. The most well-known example is RGB, where you have three primaries, one representing the red color, another representing the green color, and finally, another one representing the blue color, and you have three coordinates in the vector, RGB for each channel. If you have worked in web development, you may have seen linear transformations of RGB, such as HSL, HSI, or HSP. And the other type of color model is subtractive, which works by absorbing light in order to generate colors. The most well-known one, of course, is a model that all inkjet printers work with, which is called CMYK, for cyan, magenta, yellow, and black ink. It should be noted that subtractive colors models are not covered in this talk, so I'm not going to talk further about them. So, for an example, I told you earlier that sRGB or standard RGB powers most consumer content nowadays. It's what we call an additive color space of the RGB model. It has a standardized definition as an ISO standard published in 2002. And it has a very specific encoding. In general, most standard will tell you the conversion formulae that they intend to achieve a given bit depth. And in the case of sRGB, it is intended to be used with 8-bit unsigned integer. Now, the other relevant bit for our basics is color management. In the analog era, there was a single color space. This color space was standardized in recommendations from the International Telecommunication Union. For instance, the current version of the standard, which is BT709 from 2015, standardize the color space that is relevant for digital standard definition TV content. Of course, because it couldn't be any other way, each broadcasting standard from each country gives rise to several variations of this broadcasting color space, and we will cover these examples later. However, in the digital era, we have a different tool, This tool is called Color Management Systems. Today's color management systems follow a framework that is prescribed by another standards organization called the International Color Consortium. This framework is called Open Loop Color Management, and all calculations are done within what we call a profile connection space. This space is an intermediate device-independent color space. That means that it is very unusual to see output or input in this particular color space. Rather, we make all the conversions to and from it. That also means that primaries and illumined are not defined in the source or the destination color space, rather they are defined in this profile connection space. Finally, whenever we need to take color data from or to a device, it means that we need to transform the data from the device to the PCS and from the PCS to the destination color space. Please note the inverted directions in this transformation. This figure illustrates the open loop color management. There are many input devices, in this case cameras, and you have different types of output devices, such as a computer screen, a mobile phone, and a laser, and an inkjet printer. In all these cases, the device will tell you how to transform from its color space to the PCS, and the output device will tell you how to transform from the PCS to its own output color space. Now, to actually do color management as prescribed by the ICC, you need four key components. First, you need a common profile connection space. Then you need a color management module, which is usually a software library that performs all the color conversions. It comes usually embedded on your operating system, though if you need any particular functionality or you need a customized offering, there are offerings available from other vendors. Third, you need the device profiles, which contain the data to transform between the PCS and your device color space. This also means that our spaces are comprised within the device profiles. And finally, you have rendering intents. This is because there are usually no exact matches between two given spaces, and this gives rise to what we call out-of-gamut colors. It is the responsibility of the color management system to predictably account for this, and given a color that is out of gamut, and return a reasonable answer in the destination color space. Now, this is as much as we are going to cover as regards the ICC color management architecture. If you are interested in more, I spoke about it at length in DBox in 2022. I'm leaving the link in the description as well as in the QR code here. With this, I now conclude the first section. So let's move on to the second one, in which I will ask the question, what are these spaces? To explain this, we need to start thinking about the reason for existing of these color spaces. These spaces are made to digitally encode color signals for transmission. This means either TV, nowadays streaming or storage, etc. TUMS gives a few requirements that a good color space needs to cover. First of all, it needs to retain color balance. That is to say that a color drift between different cameras is bad. Also, color drift between different screens is bad. Second objective is to preserve the lightness information. This is because our eyes are more sensitive to light rather than to color itself. And the third objective is to achieve efficiency when transmitting color signals. For instance, if we think of a common screen cap 1080p, 8-bit RGB, which is what most color screens use nowadays, if we try to store that completely uncompressed, we need as much as 170 megabytes to store all that color data. The question that we need to ask ourselves is, how much of this space or this bandwidth, if we are streaming or transmitting, is actually needed? To clarify what I said earlier a bit, we need to think about two terms, light and color. The whole purpose of a color space is to represent faithfully the response of the eye to light stimuli. To achieve this, these luma-chroma color spaces split color information into two kinds of component. The first one is called luma, which is also known colloquially as grayscale, lightness, etc., and represents the luminosity information of the image. If you have seen monochrome images, this is exactly what luma is. And the second component is chroma, that represents actually the color itself. Now, for an actual, more precise definition of luma or luminance, if you have heard this term previously, we need to keep in mind that image transmission involves a process that is called gamma correction. In the color space standards, however, these are not actually called gamma correction, that's a misnomer from the analog era. They're actually called optoelectric transfer function. This one is applied when turning the, for instance, the input of the camera into a file. And there is a counterpart called electro-optotransfer function. This function takes the luma that is stored in the color image and turns it into the actual response that our eyes will see. These two different functions are necessary because both the image sensors and the display devices have something called non-linearity. Non-linearity means that given two consecutive levels of gray, our eyes perceive them more differently than they are actually in real life. So let's see an actual example of how gamma correction works in real life. We have on the left any input devices, in this case different types of cameras. If this camera's output is RGB, the transfer function will turn that into linear RGB, which is then transformed into the PCS by the color management system. Another transformation takes it from the PCS back to linear RGB. And finally, the optoelectronic transfer function converts it back into sRGB, and so we can see it in, for example, a screen, a mobile phone, a TV, or maybe store it into a DVD. Previously, I mixed a couple of terms, luma versus luminance. You may have also heard about chroma versus chrominance, all used interchangeably. Luma and chroma officially mean gamma corrected channels. You will see, for instance, in a standard definition, a little tilde attached to the variable name. This is usually applied to the luminosity channel only, though in very formal context, they will apply it to all the channels. For instance, if I write I tilde CBCR, which is one of the examples that we will cover later, this means that the color space will transform it from gamma corrected RGB. And there is another definition, which is luminance versus chrominance. These two terms mean linear or uncorrected channels. For instance, if we have I without tilde CBCR, this means that the color space is based on linear RGB, and this would result in very washed colors if you try to use it with gamma corrected RGB. At this rate, you may wonder, why all this baggage? This whole bit of theory is necessary because preserving color balance, as I said earlier, is essential. Any error, every mismatch that the color management system introduces in luma is very noticeable to the naked eye. However, if we make a mistake with chroma, the eye may not see it. This is a key insight that enables codecs to both drop spatial resolution and then lossily compress the color data. There's a huge benefit in this. With this change, less bandwidth or storage is required. We achieve faster transmission rates, and for instance, the same 1080p frame that we had earlier, that was 170 megabytes, if we turn it into a JPG file, we can squeeze it to less than a megabyte. There are several examples of this, for instance, GPIG, H.264, the video standard, HAVC, the new standard, PP9, AV1, the both codecs that YouTube and Twitch use now, etc., etc. All this compresses the data a lot, and make it far more affordable to be transmitted and streamed online. This whole spatial resolution dropping process is called actually chroma subsampling. In this slide, we see different types of chromosome sampling. In the first column, we see a 4x2 Luma sample. In the second column, we have different types of chroma subsampling. For instance, in the first one, we see 4 pixels of chroma. In the second, the chroma column, first we have the 4x2 block. Then we drop 2 in the horizontal direction. The other example, we drop 2 but in the vertical direction. And finally, we drop 2 and 2 on each direction. This gives rise to different chroma subsampling standards called 444, 422, 420, and 411 respectively. Now, finally, we reach the meat of this talk, that is the examples section. Luma chroma color spaces are special in the sense that they are usually transformation of existing color spaces. This means that unlike the color spaces that we see in the theory, these ones require, as a definition, the base color space, then the transformation function, which is usually, though not always, we'll see why later, a linear transformation of the source space. And finally, some color spaces may prescribe transfer functions for their operation, and this should be explicitly made available. So let's begin with the first example, which is the color space called YIQ. This color space was created in 1953 for one of the first analog broadcasting standards, which was NTSC. This makes it, as far as I believe, the oldest Luma chroma space in the imaging field. It was standardized in 2 different ITU standards. The first is called BT470 from 1998, which was superseded for compatibility reasons by BT1700, which is from 2005. In this color space, we turn gamma-corrected RGB pixels into YIQ signal values, where Y prime is the Luma signal. This is because, as we said earlier, eyes are most sensitive to the G part of the RGB pixel, and G is a major contributor to the luminance value. And R and B have smaller contributions. Then I and Q go together form the other part of the signal, which is called the chroma signal. These are complementary color difference signals. On the right, we have one example that was taken from Wikipedia, showing the whole composited image and the different parts of the color signal. A quick overview now of how the YIQ color space standard is defined. First, this color space was designed to be used for standard definition analog transmissions. Second, it uses a very old illuminant called illuminant C, which was defined in the original set, which was made in 1931. Unfortunately, this color space was quickly made obsolete with the invention of another broadcasting standard called PAL. This was unfortunate because at the time, the NTSC broadcasting standard needed very expensive analog circuitry to stabilize the signal. And here we have the set of equations that transform the RGB gamma-corrected signal into YIQ. As with most color spaces that were made for broadcasting standards, YIQ takes and returns a gamma-corrected RGB signal and also defines its own transfer functions, which are shown below. First, we have the OETF, the optoelectron transfer function, which relates the input luminance to electrical signal. And then we have the counterpart that relates the electrical signal to the output luminance. For the second example of this talk, I'm going to talk about one of the rarest color spaces out there, which is IDVDR. This colorless space entered use in France in 1967, though there were a bit of studies done much early as 1960. And its objective was to fix NTSC need for phasing and adjustment. That was the issue that I spoke about earlier. It also consumes gamma-corrected RGB pixels and outputs I prime DBTR signal values. On the right, again, we have an example. Y is the Luma signal, and DBT and DR together form the chroma signal. IDBDR was standardized together with NTSC and BAL in BT470 from 1998. However, due to its obsolescence and rarity, it didn't make it to the upgrade BT17000, so that was made obsolete. It also targets a DIC65 white point, thus beating ICBCR, which comes next. However, unlike ICBCR, it targets the analog domain entirely, so it doesn't have any transfer function. It assumes instead a power log called gamma, which equals, to 2.2 for the non-linearity of the display. Now, the start of the show, Y prime CBCR. This color space was created in 1981 as a joint project of the European Broadcasting Union and the SMPTE. Its objective is to create and power an entire digital signal compositing pipeline. It also consumes gamma-corrected RGB pixels and turns them into Y prime, CB, and CR signal values, where Y prime again is the Luma signal, and CB and CR together form the chroma signal. In this case, CB and CR have specific meanings. CB is a color difference signal comprised of blue minus luma, and CR is the difference between red and luma. There is a quick property that less than 25% of this color space reaches to valid RGB colors according to Isrevitsa-Kos law. As we will see later, this is a critical property in solving the success of YCBCR, which is a bit counterintuitively. But it was standardized by the ETU in not one, but three recommendations, like we will see next. The first version, BT601, was last updated in 2011. It targets standard definition transmissions and was designed strictly for compatibility with legacy, that is to say monochrome and TSC TVs. It also targets the DIC65 white point and has the very same gamma correction as YAQ. And here, of course, are the equations converting from RGB to YCBCR. The second version was standardized as BT709, last updated in 2015. It is a revised version that was designed to target a high-definition transmissions. This version drops legacy compatibility in exchange for a more accurate luminance response that models the response of the eye. However, it still targets a DIC65 white point and it still uses the same gamma correction as BT601. As you can see now, the equations change quite a bit compared to BT601. Finally, we have the BT2020 version, which was last updated in 2015. This is a revised version that powers 4K definition and HDR transmissions. It upgrades both the transformation matrix and the transform function, but maintains the DIC65 white point. As you can see, the equations have changed quite a bit compared to the original versions. And it also makes its own definition as regards gamma correction. BT2020, unlike previous standards, define both corrected and uncorrected version. For the sake of consistency, in this talk we will cover only the gamma corrected ICBCR version, but since we don't have a 8-bit depth, I will cover instead the 10-bit depth, which is designed for HDR. Again, the OATF relates the input luminance to the electrical signal. In this case, only one of the coefficients change. And the EOTF relates electrical signal to the output luminance. In this case, it didn't have any changes. Now, for one of the more undocumented color spaces, we have SYCC, which was standardized in 1999 as part of sRGB. This is part of an ISO standard. This color space is used by GPAG to convert the color data prior to the compression step, that is called DCT. It also consumes gamma-corrected RGB and turns it into YCBCR. However, unlike most of the ITU standards, it uses its own primaries, which are based on the sRGB primaries, not NTSC, BT709, or 2020. This also means that it allows to target the extended gamut of SYCC. That is to say, if you have colors that don't fit within sRGB, but you can capture them with your device, you can write them directly into SYCC. We enter now the fully digital era with the first color space, YCGCO, which was standardized as 8 recommendation H.273 in 2016. This one turns gamma-corrected RGB pixels into Y, CG, and CO signal values, where CG and CO, unlike previous color spaces, instead represent orange and green chroma, not chrominance as the Wikipedia page suggests. We can see the difference in the right, where we have a very clearly separated chroma, and the other two planes representing CG and CO in that order. YCGCO, as I said earlier, is standardized as E2 recommendation H.273. This standard is designed to provide a single point for all transfer functions a practitioner could probably use. And its main property is that it was designed for integer math. Its design makes it so that, for instance, if you have 8-bit sRGB and you need to convert it to YCGCO, you only need 10 bits to preserve the full N-bit RGB range, unlike previous color spaces. And here you can see the matrix transformation between gamma-corrected RGB and YCG and CO. You can see that the matrix is far more simplified compared to the previous equations. And for the final example of this talk, the newest color space I could find is ICTCP, which is a color space designed by Dolby Laboratories in 2016. This space turns a gamma-corrected RGB pixels into Y, CT, and CP signal values. Please note that there is an optative fully linear RGB version. In this case, I is the intensity or luma channel, and CT and CP together form the chroma channel. In this case, CT is called chromatitan and represents the yellow-blue hue of the color image, and CP is chromproton, it represents the red-green part of the image. This space was standardized as part of the E2 recommendation BT2100, which was published in 2018. ICTCP is the first luma chroma color space that it is not a linear transformation of a previous color space. This space, unlike all others, requires, for the first time, a complete color management transformation pipeline. And it also requires the BT2100 transfer function for a high dynamic range. This means that to go from RGB gamma corrected to ICTCP, we need to go first from gamma corrected RGB to linear RGB. Then we need to go to a color space called LMS, and there we can apply the transformation matrix to go into ICTCP. Unfortunately, to explain how LMS work and why ICTCP is so important, I will need to go into much bigger depth as regards color spaces. We need to go into the whole technical theory behind how we perceive colors, and this would turn into a whole different talk. And so we arrive to the last section, the conclusions of this talk. We have seen quite a few color spaces. They were mostly designed for analog broadcasting, but thanks to the advent of computers and phones and so on, now they are present in all everyday multimedia applications. And we covered a basic primer of color spaces. We also cover the basics of color management, why are blue monochrome color spaces so essential, and finally the examples that are in wide use today. As I said earlier, we didn't cover the full background behind color spaces. For instance, we didn't cover concepts such as trichromacy, LM sequence response functions, and so on. We also didn't cover what's needed for 4K and HDR transmissions. For instance, why ICVCR is so surpassed by ICTCP in digital workflows. This is because the technical concepts behind ICTCP are so complicated that would make this whole talk at a very different technical level than just an introduction. But if you are feeling so inclined to read a bit more about color spaces, I added extra references at the end of the slides provided with this talk. So that's all for today. Thank you all for watching. If you have any questions, we have a Q&A section next. Or if you want, you can write an email or drop me a line of Matrix and I will answer as soon as I can. Thank you all for watching. See you soon.
Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for the amazing talk, Amy. We've got a few questions. So, first of all, YCBCR, is it still in wide use today?
Yeah. I know for a fact that some applications, like satellites, cannot put TIFF images in that format, but they are really extremely rare. I could never get a sample of one of them. And to the best of my knowledge, there is only just the one application that can support uncompressing and viewing those images. And for the love of God, please don't ask about ICVCR GPIG compressed TIFF, because those are the most coarse type of file format and they are best left in the history.
How difficult would it be to explain ICTCP compared to YCBCR?
Well, ICTCP is not a linear transformation over RGB like every Luma-Chroma color space that came before it. It's actually a transformation over how our eyes perceive the color. And to explain that, I need to go to the very basics of color spaces, in particular, why we need three primaries and not four and not two. That's called trichromacy theory. And I would also need to explain one ISO standard on its own, that's a CIE standard observer functions. Those are the ones that describe how we see colors and put numbers to it. So that will be a whole different talk.
So why didn't you mention color spaces like OKLab, CIE Lab, LCH, or XYZ?
I didn't have time, unfortunately. Here in Argentina, we had a massive storm some 2 weeks ago. We lost power for a whole weekend. The uplink was also cut until the Friday, last Friday. And I needed to hand in a big, very big project before we went all at work for the Christmas break. So if anyone wants to hear more about them, please write some lines on my Matrix or send me an email. And I make sure to put together a part two of this talk.
That sounds amazing. Thank you. So what else are you working on?
At present, I'm working in the assembly SIMD region. I just finished a very big project for work. I implemented ABX acceleration for GStreamer. That was a 4-month long project, which I ended up trying to finish by looking into the microcode implementation of AMD Zen. It was really something that was far more complicated than I had imagined, and I hope that we can get to share that with you very, very soon.
That honestly sounds like a really interesting project. I think I'd enjoy watching you talk about that. So anything you want to work on in the future?
Well, there is, has been a kind of an achievement to be unlocked for me that is working in HDR. That's high dynamic range. So to put it in very simple words, imagine that our screens can put a certain amount of light. And if you have a screen that supports HDR, you can literally put like three or four times the amount of light and also cover a much wider range of color. But unfortunately, in order to do that, you need a whole lot of equipment. It cannot be simulated with normal screens. And that's, of course, really, really expensive. But I hope to get to work on that next year.
Honestly, that's a shame that the equipment is not easily affordable. Thank you very much for your talk. It was extremely interesting, and it was an excellent addition and a further view into the magic of color.
Thank you.
I've been told not to ask you about the car, so I will not do so. One last thing, people in the chat have been meowing, so meow.
Meow.
Thanks again for your talk.
Thank you. See you soon.